This is Our America's, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. In the next half hour, we'll play two more speeches given at last month's historic conference held in New York and in Puerto Rico entitled Race and the Construction of the Puerto Rican Identity. The two-part series of meetings and workshops examine the African presence in Puerto Rico and how the issue of race has been superseded in the Puerto Rican national dialogue by the never-ending question of the island's political status. We played some highlights a couple of weeks ago on Our Americas. Today we'll hear from two voices who examine how race and identity affect the Puerto Rican experience here in the United States. Coming up next on Our Americas. Weeks ago, we presented a speech given by veteran Puerto Rican journalist and educator Enid Rute Gomez about the issue of race and the construction of the Puerto Rican identity. It was the keynote speech given at the conference of the same title, which was organized by the Caribbean Cultural Center of New York and the University of Puerto Rico. The purpose of the conference was to examine how race has affected Puerto Rican politics and culture, not only on the island but in the diaspora, and how racism continues to permeate the Puerto Rican society in general. The conference participants gave an historical overview of the African presence in Puerto Rico and touched on a number of basic issues, including relations between blacks and Latinos in the U.S., the nature and roots of Puerto Rico as a mixed-race society, how spiritual and cultural movements in Puerto Rico have affected racial identities both on the island and in the diaspora, and the impact Puerto Rico's colonial status has had on the struggle for equality on the island. Today we'll present two unique aspects of this dialogue. We'll hear from Puerto Rican scholar Raquel Rivera, a youth activist and PhD candidate from the City University of New York, who'll make some reflections on race and youth culture in the Puerto Rican community. But first, we'll hear from Dr. Manning Marable, the director of the Institute of Research in African American Studies at Columbia University and author of numerous books on blacks and black history here in the United States. Marable outlines the need to build bridges between African American and Latino communities in the U.S.
Building bridges between Latino and black communities as a radical political project requires us to critically re-examine both our theoretical paradigms of what race is, recognizing that race as an expression of political economy is never static, it is dynamic. And as it mutates and changes, requires us to rethink political strategy in approaches of building bridges as well. Any discussion about race and ethnicity as social forces within both the Black American and Puerto Rican experiences, as well as more broadly the Latino experience in colonized societies in the Americas, must begin from the vantage point of history. There are, in the development of colonial societies in the Americas and in this case, in the United States, there were three great social divisions which, from the very beginning, fostered social hierarchies of power and privilege and sets of dependent relations. The first was the division between Europeans versus non-Europeans, particularly African slaves and indigenous Americans. The second was the division between capital and labor, the conflict between those privileged elites who controlled the land and productive resources versus those who lived by their labor power. And third, the gender stratification between women and men, the superiority granted to males by the patriarchal weight of law, property ownership, political enfranchisement, and physical violence and social control. Each of these great divisions contributed to the historical construction of national identities in the U.S. and in varying degrees throughout the colonized Americas and Caribbean, which came to be known, largely defined, as whiteness, racial categories of privilege, which rationalized and justified the domination of and exploitation of those defined as others, who were overwhelmingly non-European, poor, and or female. These three great divisions, very different yet overlapping hierarchies of domination, formed the foundations of what ethnic studies scholars Michael Omi and Howard Winant have termed a racial formation. Historically, whiteness evolved as a racial category of privilege, which was accessible only to immigrants of European origin, with some important exceptions, and I want to talk about that in a few minutes. Whiteness was, in effect, the entry point of passage through which European colonialists competed with each other for power and status. The white community in the United States, for example, was deeply stratified by race, by gender, and class inequalities. But nearly all individuals who could claim the status of whiteness stood above the abyss of inferiority and subordination, which black and brown and Native American people had been plummeted. Phenotype and physical appearance were used in this system as very rough indicators to determine the individual's access to resources, power, and property. But as powerful as that code of color was, class division still largely, if not exclusively, prefigured the range of possibilities for the dynamics of racialized ethnicity. In other words, every racial formation exists within a political economy and a social class structure, which does not dictate, but does largely prefigure, the set of alternatives which can develop within social relations. As modes of production develop and change, as the organization of labor and the economy change, the social configuration and social manifestations of race, what we mean by that, also mutate into new forms. Because the dominant role of race and racism in the U.S. social formation, European immigrants who arrived here quickly learned that the key to their advancement was to claim the status of being white. In other words, during the 19th century, race was far more powerful in determining what sociologists call one's life chances than what we would today call ethnicity. So, for example, Irish, who for centuries had been an oppressed nation, experienced severe discrimination on their arrival. But within several generations in the U.S., they had become, quote-unquote, white. There's a very funny book, an interesting book by Noel Ignatieff that many of you are probably familiar with. Has a great title, How the Irish Became White. Conversely, immigrants from Latin America and Asia were frequently racialized, both by legislative means, that is, by actions of the state, and by de facto segregation within society. For example, Chinese immigrants were subject to legal restrictions as early as 1870. In 1942, with the outbreak of World War II, 110,000 Japanese Americans were forcibly removed from their homes into detention camps. It was only with the passage of the McCarran-Walter Act in 1952 that Asians born outside of the U.S. were even allowed to become U.S. citizens. An even more complicated racial coding process developed for Latinos. And here I'll cite the example of Mexican Americans. After the U.S.-Mexican War of 1846-48, the U.S. incorporated about one half of Mexico's entire territory into its own legal boundaries. Slavery, which had been previously abolished by the Mexican government, was reestablished. Only Mexicans who were defined as Spanish or white could claim U.S. citizenship. Indians, peasants, and mestizos were treated as inferior groups by law and social practice. Now, scholars agree today that racialization is a social and historical process, that races aren't fixed as categories. They are permeated by changing contours of gender, class, nationality, and even sexual orientation. If that is all true, then we must recognize, as historians and political activists, that an oppressed race, quote-unquote, in one historical epoch, such as the Irish or Jews, can become incorporated into the privileged strata of, quote-unquote, whiteness. Racial designations of identical cultural groups may differ from country to country and from diverse historical sites, places, and times. Moreover, what complicates all this is that the capitalist state always has a vested interest in the management of diversity. Good example, the U.S. government's decision in 1971 to establish a new, quote, ethnic but not racial, quote, unquote, category of, quote, unquote, Hispanic is the best example of state manipulation of the politics of difference. The designation, quote-unquote, Hispanic, was imposed on over 20 million people, both legal residents and undocumented immigrants, who had very different nationalities, national cultures, racialized ethnic identities, social institutions, and distinct political memories and histories. But the government's attempt to regulate difference as a matter of public policy does inevitably impact how many people perceive themselves within daily life. Are, for example, Chicanos also quote-unquote Hispanics, or are they Latinos, Or do they have more in common with the Mexicans who live in territories that once belonged to them? The quote-unquote Hispanic legal category encompasses extraordinarily different groups. Upper middle class immigrants from Argentina, Uruguay, and Chile, black working class Puerto Ricans, Panamanians, and Dominicans, an anti-Castro Cuban exile community that now forms much of Dade County's Florida ruling political elite and professional class, and Chicano farm workers in California's agricultural districts. Which of these distinct nationalities and cultural groups may largely determine what the quote-unquote Hispanic legal construct or social construct may become in terms of the substance of its materiality, its social materiality? As in every social construct, each group's collective identity is a product of political and social contestations, ideological conflicts, class and gender stratifications. Increasingly, it seems probable to me that in the near future, some of these racialized ethnics will be incorporated into the social category of white privilege through a combination, perhaps, of class upward mobility, racial ethnic intermarriage, residential segregation, and their assimilation of white conservative political behavior and voting patterns. The central driving force today behind the contemporary reconfiguration of the U.S. racialized social formation is immigration. In the 1980s, there were nearly 9 million immigrants who legally entered the United States, more than in any decade since 1910. In 1989 alone, about 1.2 million immigrants were admitted for permanent residence, the highest number since 1914. By 1996, there were 5 million undocumented workers in the United States at minimum, with about two-thirds of them from Central America, Mexico, and the Latino Caribbean. Illegal immigration has now in the United States become a multi-billion dollar enterprise. Nationwide, about one-third of the total growth of the U.S. labor force, the entire U.S. labor force, in the 1990s has come from both illegal and legal immigration. In New York City alone in 1990, according to scholar Peter Kwong, there were nearly 5,000 businesses that employed over 50,000 undocumented workers working in sweatshop conditions. Building bridges between Puerto Ricans, especially, and Latinos in general with blacks will require the recognition of how the racialized capitalist economy works to subordinate each of these groups, not as past historical processes, but today. There are many ways to measure the powerful reality of contemporary racism upon Latinos and blacks. For example, a 1994 study of the Office of Personnel Management found that African-American federal employees were more than twice as likely to be fired or dismissed than their white counterparts. Blacks are especially likely, it's interesting to note, to be fired at much higher rates than whites in jobs where they comprise a significant share of the labor force. For example, black clerk typists are 4.5 times more likely to be fired to be dismissed than whites. Discrimination is also rampant in the capital markets. Banks continue policies of redlining, denying loans in neighborhoods which are largely Latino and black. In New York City, for example, according to the Federal Reserve Board, Latinos and blacks are turned down for mortgage applications by banks, savings and loans, and other financial institutions about twice as often as whites. And even after years of affirmative action programs, blacks and Latinos remained both grossly underrepresented in a wide number of professions. For example, blacks and Latinos represent roughly 12.8% and a little more than 10.5%, respectively, of the U.S. adult populations. But of all American physicians, blacks account for barely 4.2%, Latinos 5.2%. Among engineers, blacks represent 3.7%, Latinos 3.3%. Among attorneys, blacks account for 3.3%, Latinos 3.1%. Of all college and university professors, blacks comprise 5%, Latinos 3.2%. Building bridges between Latino and black communities means, in practical political terms, that we must break from the zero-sum game of trying to attack racial barriers at each other's expense. The tragedy here is that too little is done either by black or Latino, quote-unquote, mainstream leaders to transcend their parochialism and redefine their agendas on common ground. Most Latinos and blacks who are working and poor people can overwhelmingly agree on a list of common issues, such as the inclusion of multicultural curricula in public schools, the improvements in public health care, job training initiatives, the expansion of public transportation and housing for low to moderate income people, and greater fairness and legal rights within the criminal justice system. There is also substantial evidence that in elementary, secondary, and higher education, Latinos continue to experience discrimination more severe in many respects than that experienced by black Americans. For example, although high school graduation rates for entire populations have steadily improved, rates for Latinos have consistently declined since the mid-1980s. By 1992, the high school completion rate for Latino males in the U.S. had dropped to only 47.8%, the lowest figure ever recorded by the American Council on Education since it began compiling statistics a quarter century ago. In colleges and universities, the pattern of Latino inequality was the same. In 1991, 34% of all whites and 24% of all black Americans from the ages of 18 to 24 were enrolled in college. As of 1992, 22% of non-Latino population held four-year college degrees. But as of 1995, the college graduation rate for Latinos was only 10%. Thus, on a whole series of issues, from education, housing, health care, jobs, civil rights, civil rights enforcement, criminal justice, the Latinos and black Americans share a common set, a core set of interests in what is required, both from the grounds of theory and practical politics, is a creative visionary leadership that allows us to bridge the cultural, language, and ethnic divisions to begin a genuine dialogue of mutual respect. Together, not apart, Latinos and blacks can win the fight for equality and social justice, even in this racialized capitalist state. Thank you.
Dr. Manning Marable is the director of the Institute of Research in African American Studies at Columbia University. He was speaking at Race and the Construction of the Puerto Rican Identity, a conference organized by the Caribbean Cultural Center of New York and the University of Puerto Rico back in April. And you're listening to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. As we continue playing highlights from the conference, we go now to Puerto Rican scholar Raquel Rivera, a youth activist and PhD candidate from the City University of New York. In her presentation, Rivera makes some reflections on race and youth culture in the Puerto Rican community, something she called rap music and power dynamics.
My main two questions that are guiding these thoughts are, how do Puerto Rican youth identities and experiences get articulated in rap music, and what kind of power dynamics are at play within rap? First, just a little bit of background. Hip-hop culture began in the South Bronx in the 1970s, and it was mainly developed by African Americans, Puerto Ricans, and other Afro-Caribbeans. And when I talk about hip-hop culture, I'm not just talking about rap music, but I'm also talking about other artistic elements of hip-hop culture, like graffiti and b-boying or breaking. Rap music is a phenomenon which thrives both through everyday experience and mass mediation. Puerto Ricans have been key participants in the development of hip-hop in the U.S. since its early days. However, they have had a marginal participation in terms of the U.S.-based media, for which hip-hop is basically an African-American cultural form, and Puerto Ricans don't really factor into the equation. Rap in Puerto Rico has not only been developed through the imitation of a mass-mediated phenomenon, but its development in the island has also been related to the Puerto Rican migratory experience, where youths from both sides of El Charco influence each other's cultural production. New Yorkans have been notable in the development of hip-hop art forms in the island and vice versa. The back-and-forth flow is often unbalanced and wavers constantly, but there's no doubt that these cultural exchanges have been really important for cultural production in both places. One of the most noteworthy aspects of hip-hop culture is the way in which it has engaged with racial structures of oppression. Though nominal praises of Puerto Rican negrura have been made in other musical genres, the connection made in rap between racial and class structures of oppression is unprecedented. The connection between poverty, race, and social prejudice is constantly talked about, particularly as it affects young males. the state and its institutions, particularly the police, are viewed with suspicion, if not outright hostility. A street or ghetto blackness, which is also young, male, and heterosexual, but I'll get into that later on. So the street or ghetto blackness is the dominant identity articulated in hip-hop art forms. Not only is Puerto Rican blackness claimed and praised, but there's also a connection drawn between the experiences and history of African Americans and Puerto Ricans through rap music. This vindication of blackness is undoubtedly related to the black nationalist phase that rap music in the U.S. went through in the late 80s. One of the questions that has popped up for a lot of people is why within rap there's more of an emphasis on blackness instead of going along with the dominant discourse of racial integration or mixed race or mulatto-ness among Puerto Ricans. And I think it's because since that dominant racial discourse, although it emphasizes race mixing, still it has been through a privileging of whiteness that race mixing has been put out there. So the people that are engaged in hip hop, I think, have decided, well, since this race mixing has really privileged Europeanness or whiteness, then we're going to privilege blackness, at least in symbolic terms. These classed and racially based identities, according to which hip-hop cultural production tends to be articulated, frequently elide national boundaries to make transnational connections along class and racial lines. But this drawing of transnational connections doesn't preclude the use of national symbols and sources in rap music. Edwin Reyes, who is a poet and a writer for Claridad, described rap in the newspaper Claridad, based in Puerto Rico, as a, and this is a quote, primitive form of musical expression hailing from the ghetto, which transmits the most elementary forms of emotion through its brutalizing and aggressive monotony. This insidious description is an example of how rap is perceived as the cultural expression of that most primitive, dark, and dangerous sector of the population, an element of corruption within the nation. Rappers are the feared techno-aborigines, and that's a quote from another writer from Puerto Rico, Santos. And these techno-aborigines are disdained for being part of a marginal population allegedly unable to express itself in an intelligent, sublime, or profound manner. Now, as I mentioned before, there are a few more other categories of identity that are typically articulated through hip-hop. It's not only about class and race-based identity, but also about a young male heterosexual identity. And a symbolic power resides in those that are able to embody and articulate all those identity categories. And that doesn't mean that women don't participate in hip-hop art forms. A few women rappers and reggae singers have garnered considerable popularity in the island and over here also. And I'll just mention briefly in the island, Lisa M, Francesca, Ivy Queen, and Glory. And over here, recently Hurricane G, in years past, the real Roxanne. And some of these women have actually expressed themselves against gender inequality in their rhymes, but they are the exceptions that prove the rule. Women, for the most part, are indispensable but secondary participants. The video cuties in bikinis, the booty shaking dancers on stage, the sexually available girls on the dance floor. And it's rarely that women get to be the respected DJ or the respected rapper or producer. The way in which femaleness is imagined and embodied, incidentally, clashes with the avowedly pro-black ethos of hip hop. Femaleness remains irremediably tied to a stereotypical of feminine beauty. And this beauty, in turn, is defined through Eurocentric notions where dark skin, white nose and lips, and nappy hair have no place. And blackness in a man is not seen as problematic because men can be, don't have to follow this standard of prettiness. Or not even the standard, but it just looks don't matter as much in terms of men. Rap has been an agent of power in terms of enforcing patriarchal structures of oppression. It has, for the most part, been implicated in reproducing our society's sexist and homophobic norms. Though challenging class and racial structures of oppression, it's largely still in compliance with sexism and homophobia. The youths engaged in rap have been often understood and portrayed in the media as misogynist deviants who take part in a pathological criminal culture. But what is seldom mentioned is that they are mimicking the dominant cultural values learned through passive and acritical consumption. Rap lyrics take part in the reproduction of the dominant sexist ideology that perpetuates the myths, the stereotypes, repressions, and double standards that cement patriarchy. The crucial difference between the misogyny that passes uncommented and that which triggers a vociferous public reaction, like in terms of rap, is that rap expresses vulgarly and without the least bit of decorum the same sexist ideas that we hear everywhere else. So let's backtrack a bit to the identity categories that are define the dominant rap aesthetic. Rap brandishes a proverbial ghetto-ness, blackness, heterosexual maleness, and youthfulness as badges of honor. And these are the same identity categories that are defined by the dominant public discourse, particularly in state and media rhetoric, as the markings of marginality, danger, and criminality. Rap self-identification with blackness, youthful maleness, ghetto hardness, and lawlessness is an attempt at vindicating urban marginality. But at the same time, this self-construction can be argued to be a defeatist celebration of the stereotypes associated with poor urban populations. Rap is an arena of representations and lived relations where identity categories are forged, contested, and reshaped. It's also a realm of constant power plays, both at the level of human relations and also at the level of artistic representation. Rap is about reality, and it's also about fantasy. It's about materiality, and it's about social structures, but it's also about artistic creativity. Though certain views and trends tend to dominate within rap, it's still not a monolith. All rap doesn't express the same views. It's more a vehicle for expression than just something that embodies a certain approach. Rap is sometimes a response to certain structures of oppression, and rap other times reproduces structures of oppression. Rap is sometimes about serious issues spoken from the mind and intellect, and other times, as the rapper from the island, Frankie Boy, put it, it's just about ganas de joder y llevar la contraria. Thank you.
Raquel Rivera is a youth activist and PhD candidate from the City University of New York. She was speaking at Race and the Construction of the Puerto Rican Identity, a conference held last month in New York City and in Puerto Rico. We'll play more highlights of the conference in the coming weeks as we continue our year-long look at various aspects of the Puerto Rican experience on this, the 100th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Puerto Rico. If you want tapes of the conference, you can call us at 212-279-0707. That's 212-279-0707. And that's about all the time we have on today's program. Our Americas is produced at the studios of WBAI Pacifica Radio in cooperation with NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America. It is funded in part by grants from the Paul Robeson Fund for Independent Media, the Funding Exchange, and the New York State Council on the Arts. If you have any questions or comments, you can send us an email at mmcompa@igc.org. For Our Americas, I'm Mario Murillo. Thanks for listening, and stay strong.
Come on, trooper, I got an hour. Make it round, you're a vibe. Power.